Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Jane Pepper, who after almost 30 years as president of the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society, retires this week. David Patrick Stearns profiles Dee Wu. The Curtis-trained pianist is one of classical music's most talked about rising stars. Susan Lewis considers the University of Pennsylvania Museum exhibition fulfilling a prophecy, the past and present of the Lenape in Pennsylvania. And Tom Keels takes us to Philadelphia on Stone, an exhibition at the Library Company of Philadelphia exploring how local lithographers have depicted their city from the 1800s to the present day. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Scottish-born and raised Jane Pepper says she came to America by accident and stayed by accident. These two happy life detours were to have a huge effect on the city where she settled. This week, Jane Pepper retired as president of the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society, where, in her nearly 30 years as president, she grew the Philadelphia Flower Show from a regional event into one of the largest exhibitions of its kind in the world. The success of the now internationally renowned Flower Show has fueled other important PHS efforts, like Philadelphia Green, a program designed to revitalize and maintain the city's green infrastructure as a key element in urban renewal. Philadelphia Green works with community partners to improve streetscapes by planting and maintaining trees and shrubs, to reclaim and beautify abandoned land in blighted neighborhoods, and to revitalize parks and other public spaces. Despite being a force of and for nature, Pepper is often self-deprecating, deflecting praise to others. She's been nicknamed the Iron Butterfly for her soft-spoken yet tenacious approach to getting things done. Earlier this week, we caught up with Jane Pepper at an event in her honor at the Chanticleer House and Garden in suburban Philadelphia.
Okay, so let's get nostalgic about it. When you came here in
1979,
describe what it was like then and what happened since.
Well, we had a wonderful leader in those days, Ernesta Ballard, and so I worked with her for almost a year, and I was very lucky to do that because she had some great ideas about the future of our city. Flower Show was a lot smaller. It wasn't international. It wasn't in the convention center. Philadelphia Green was in its emerging phase. And so many things have happened since then. Thousands of acres of vacant land that we've rehabilitated. The Azalea Garden, the landscaping at the Art Museum, Logan Circle. All of those things have happened in the past 30 years thanks to the wonderful staff at PHS.
Let's talk about, say, the Flower Show just in terms of the number of visitors and just in terms of the amount of money being spent on it.
Well, we probably, I think our high was something like 175,000 visitors at that time, and we have been up around 250,000, 230,000 every year.
And the scale of it, because now people talk about it being second only to the London or the Chelsea Flower Show.
It used to be 6 acres, and now it's 10 acres, and the design quality of the show is excellent. And now that we have a much bigger place to hold it in, we can be a lot more dramatic because the ceiling there is 52 feet high. And that's one of our big challenges always, is try to figure out how you make people look up into something beautiful like the balloon that we had this year, as opposed to looking up into the rafters of the convention center.
And what drove you to drive this?
Well, Philadelphia is a fantastic place for horticulture. It's a perfect climate for what we have in the U.S. If you're not going to have England or Portland, Philadelphia is about as good as you can get. And the number of enthusiastic exhibitors and volunteers, about 3,500 volunteers total.
Let's talk about Philadelphia Green, because people talk about that as being your pet project. You say it was started, or it was in its infancy when you got here, but it really has developed under your watch.
It's developed under my watch, and also I have to give a lot of credit to Blaine Bonham, who's also retiring this year, and he's done an incredible job of leading that team. And if I look at the original, he was out there with a truck and a vegetable garden, and it grew from that into the parks program, into the vacant land program, street tree planting, and it's just gone out from there because Philadelphia has a lot of land that we want to make look more beautiful.
And was that something that was peculiar to Philadelphia, or was it already happening in other cities?
It was happening in other cities, but not to the same extent, because the flower show made it all possible for us to do pilot projects, and then in turn we got support from foundations, and now we have a lot of activity that goes on with the city of Philadelphia, because they very much want to have our neighborhoods and our downtown look more beautiful.
In terms of what you've started, the Flower Show, Philadelphia Green, and all of the activities of the Horticultural Society, where would you like to see it for your successor in, I don't know, 10 years?
I think there's a lot that we can continue to do in Philadelphia. And also I think the whole public piece of it, getting people involved, planting trees in their neighborhoods and also in the suburbs, because we have an important role that we can play out in the burbs, helping our members understand the importance of trees and plants and compost heaps and all that environmental piece that we all have to get behind if we're going to survive into the future. And PHS can be a real leader and a collaborator, because we have more amazing arboretums, botanic gardens in this area than many, many people have in other parts of the country.
I have to, before we finish, refer to your nickname, which is much bandied about, as the Iron Butterfly. What do you understand by that nickname?
Well, you know, you take your nicknames as you can get them, and it's a lot better than the nickname that I've had in prior parts of my life. So I'll take that one anytime.
What does it mean?
I guess it means that I'm reasonably polite about when I'm trying to do something that's maybe not so popular.
And? That's the butterfly part?
That's the butterfly part of it. But being firm. And you have a lot of times when you have to say no to somebody, and hopefully I do it with a grace that makes them accept it and keeps us friends to go forward, because that's what I want out of my life, is to have good relationships with people so that you can make things work together.
Jane Pepper, who retired as president of the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society this week. Listen here to find out about her next big career move.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Up-and-coming Chinese pianist Di Wu has a way of attracting large audiences in unusual places, and even she isn't sure why. Last summer, after she made a good showing at the Van Cliburn Piano Competition, she played a recital at Longwood Gardens that attracted more than 2,000 people, with others trying to buy tickets in mid-performance. Under the aegis of Philadelphia's Astral Artists, the 25-year-old pianist made a critically acclaimed Philadelphia recital debut in October. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns paid her a visit at the Juilliard School last fall and also spoke with Gary Grafman, her teacher from her Curtis Institute years.
We all know that child prodigies are getting younger, but Di Wu would seem to have them all beat. According to her MySpace profile, she made her concert debut at the age of one. You have to wonder how that worked.
Age one. Oh my gosh, it's my fault. I know probably what happened. Because I built my own website, so I can update them daily. I mean, weekly. I can actually just go home right now. Go back to any computer right now and do it right there. But that's not good. No.
Such are the perils of a do-it-yourself career. Unlike her colleagues and contemporaries at the Beijing Central Conservatory, who include the well-established Long Long, Yuja Wang, and Yundi Li, Di Wu doesn't have a recording contract or management. If she has a problem, it's motivation. She perhaps has too much of it.
And as an artist, we always talk about this kind of starving artist concept. You know, we need to survive. We need to make enough money to live. And that was my main concern. I want to make sure that next year I have money to live on. But at the same time, of course, I really try to organize my life much better, and so that I can enjoy the practice, and not by the time I get to the practice time, I'm so tired already. I just made 30 calls in a day, and I'm already tired, and I don't have the brain to think about music.
Her repertoire is fearless. Her one recording made 3 years ago includes the Liszt Sonata in B minor, Last spring, with Camden Symphony in C, she played the Rachmaninoff Piano Concerto No. 3. She doesn't play it safe. One teacher compared her to a wild horse. Gary Grafman, her Curtis Institute teacher, has to tell her to slow down. When her adrenaline kicks in, she sometimes tries to play the music faster than her fingers can possibly manage.
Playing is like walking a balance beam. It's such a fine line between being involved and being logically aware. You are, first of all, the person who comes up with the idea, the creative person. And then you have the second person being, you know, the performer who executes the idea. But the most important, you need to be the third person who pretends that they sit in the audience and feeds back to what's actually going on to the first person. And remember not to get too involved so that you actually are touching yourself, but you're not touching the audience.
Her ambition is typical of Chinese pianists. Now that they aren't confined to their national borders, the case with past regimes, they seem to be bursting out all over the world, and boy, are they competitive. Gary Grafman, who taught Long Long, Yuzhu Wang, and Di Wu, says the attitude is embedded in their culture.
Everything in China is competition. I mean, from the earliest dynasties, where thousands of people were invited from the provinces to compete for three places to work in the imperial palace as wood carvers, as painters, calligraphers, and so forth. And everything was geared to being better than somebody else, and that's a mentality.
Even for those who triumph in China, life is hard. Long Long wrote a biography that talked about parental abuse and having to live in squalor while attending the Central Conservatory in Beijing. Di Wu's parents were a genteel pair of teachers. They didn't push her. Still, the juggernaut that is the Chinese educational system meant that early on, she was at a point of no return. Studying music at an early age comes at the expense of a more general education in China, and to quit music after a few years would have left her hopelessly behind in any other endeavor. And the Beijing living quarters that she shared with her mother weren't quite as bad as Long Long's, but she still had only half as much space as your average Juilliard practice room.
So we had a piano, a bed, and one of those burning coal places for warmth and for cooking, and a sink. And I was so happy that we had a sink. And so therefore, there's no bathroom. And if you're going to go to the bathroom, there is one like down the aisle, but it's like there's no light, the dark spider webs everywhere. So, but that's a living situation. We all live in something like that. I mean, there are worse. That's why I said we had a sink. Oh my God, at least there's like fresh water.
A series of contacts and a great deal of luck getting a visa brought her to the Manhattan School of Music. However, the fact that she had to attend a professional children's high school in New York drained her family savings. The Curtis Institute of Music, which has only students on scholarship, saved her life, so to speak. After 5 years there, she graduated at age 21, but didn't feel ready to go out on her own. She subsequently earned a master's degree and an artist diploma at Juilliard. If she has a challenge now, it's to keep focused on the music. When she first entered the Van Cliburn competition, she didn't even come close to doing her best.
I was so overwhelmed. I read too much newspapers. I was so concerned with everything else except for playing. And you feel the world is watching. That affected me to no end. I wasn't making music on stage. I was worried about not making mistakes. And that was the only thing I was thinking about. And I felt like I need to give 120%. And that's not a healthy thinking, especially at Cliburn. If you can give yourself 80% of your best, 80% of your best at Cliburn, it's like amazing under all the pressure. And I was thinking 120. So I freaked myself out.
Then again, Di Wu isn't the sort of pianist that usually wins Cliburn. She takes too many chances.
I do, because otherwise what's the fun? I mean, it's not what's the fun, but what's the point? If you don't take chances, yes, you tend to get shut down more. But at the same time, I mean, that's music. If I'm about to play like all the others are playing, then why play? I mean, I'm not trying to make a difference just for the sake of different, be different. But I'm trying to do this because that's how I hear it. At least that's what I feel. And I, you know, people can feel free to disagree with me, but I would rather people to have a reaction to my playing than be neutral about it. I'm a very emotional person. Therefore, I feel things. When I'm happy, I'm the happiest. And when I feel sad, I'm the saddest. You know, I feel things to the extremes. And I think maybe that's where my strength is.
Chinese pianist Di Wu, ending that profile by the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. According to conventional history, few, if any, Lenape Indians remained in Pennsylvania after the 18th century, most having been killed or driven west by European settlers. However, an exhibition at the University of Pennsylvania Museum tells the story of those who stayed, forming communities whose members hid their Lenape identities, yet managed to continue and pass on their traditions in secret for nearly two centuries. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to Fulfilling a Prophecy, the Past and the Present of the Lenape in Pennsylvania.
When University of Pennsylvania anthropology student Abigail Selden was putting together a one-case exhibit about what happened to the Lenape people, she met with the elders of today's Lenape Nation of Pennsylvania and asked them why there was virtually nothing about them in the literature.
Every book I've read says that you don't exist and that you're not in Pennsylvania anymore. And they said, yeah, we know. I said, but you're here. And they said, well, we've been keeping our history a secret for 200 years, so of course it's not in the books.
The Lenape's cautious willingness to share their history was a doorway, opened a crack, into another culture, a natural fit with a museum dedicated to understanding the world's cultural heritage, let alone one in its own backyard. Selden's advisor, anthropology professor Bob Prusell, curator of North America at the Penn Museum, says that while most of the cultures in the museum are presented at a point in the past...
For example, ancient Egypt, we have incredible collections here, but there's not a lot on contemporary Egypt here. So one of the things that we want to do with Native America is to show the continuities and connections between the archaeology, the history, and the contemporary communities.
So what started out as a small student project grew into a museum show covering hundreds of years. Co-curated by Selden, along with Chief Bob Red Hawk Ruth and Shelley DePaul of the Lenape Nation, it took its shape and context from a story handed down through the generations called Prophecy of the Fourth Crow, about, among other things, hiding and returning.
Long ago it was said that a fox will be loosened on the earth. Also, it was said four crows will come.
As the story goes, the first crow flew in harmony with the Creator. The second crow tried to clean the world, but he became sick and died. The third crow saw his dead brother, and he hid. The fourth crow flew the way of harmony again with the Creator. The ending comes full circle.
Caretakers, they will live together on the earth.
As told here, the first crow in the prophecy corresponds to the Lenape before the first contact with Europeans. The second crow represents the period from about 1600 until 1800, when initially peaceful coexistence with William Penn and others deteriorated in subsequent generations. This is starkly illustrated by an enlarged 1764 ad placed by one of William Penn's sons in Benjamin Franklin's Pennsylvania Gazette.
John Penn is offering payment to civilians who capture Delaware or Lenape individuals or who kill them and turn in their scalps as evidence. And the payment for a male over 10 years of age was $134 and for a female $50. So there was a really clear heritage in Pennsylvania of indiscriminate violence against people of Native American heritage.
By the beginning of the 19th century, remaining Lenape had either fled or gone into hiding. And it is the next 200 years of secrecy, represented by the third crow, that is the driving force of this exhibition. Chief Bob Redhawk says his people found ways to survive.
Whether it was intermarriage, whether it was hiding who you are, you did whatever you could. If you could pass as a white or even as African-American, and this is even during segregation times, we were low men on the totem pole.
Passing as members of other ethnic groups was in some cases made easier because intermarriage was common. Selden says Lenape women, for example, married German farmers and kept connections to their land. Generations of intermarriage eventually created a population with looks as diverse as the larger culture. Children could be blonde and fair-skinned, dark with black hair, and everything in between. Outwardly, they assumed a non-Lenape identity. In the privacy of family gatherings, they continued to practice Lenape traditions and pass down stories. Even outward appearances were full of symbols, as shown in this exhibition on things as ordinary as a kitchen apron with a particular stitch along the bottom, or a wooden fence post with a subtle carving.
Poles like this one were scattered throughout farmland. This has a face on it pretty clearly, but it could just be a signpost.
And what is the face?
It represents Mising, who's the protector of the woodlands.
The importance of secrecy was drummed into the youngest of children, as evidenced by a rag doll in this show.
If you look carefully underneath her hair, which is now pulled to both sides, you can see that there's a second face. And this was a doll that was made for a little girl by her Lenape grandmother in the 1940s. And the woman told the little girl that this doll had the second face and that this represented the little girl's Lenape face and her identity, which she had to keep a secret because she could not tell anybody who she was.
Secrecy, rooted in fear, became part of the culture. But now, perhaps it is indeed the time of the fourth crow. In recent years, more people have begun to openly acknowledge their Lenape heritage, particularly as caretakers of nature. In 2002, the Lenape Nation signed the first Treaty of Brotherhood, with churches and other community groups pledging to support the Lenape cultural education programs and their work for the environment. The chief himself has traveled openly internationally, on tour with his large drum, which for now sits in a gallery at the Penn Museum, along with artifacts and photographs, evidence of children and parents, grandparents and great-grandparents.
These people were living, breathing people, and it's because of their ways of surviving that we're here today, and we're hoping that our children can come in here now and be proud.
It is their story, and it is our story. A rich texture in the national fabric, an important part of what it means to be an American, native or not.
That report was by WRTI's Susan Lewis. Fulfilling a prophecy, the past and present of the Lenape in Pennsylvania is at the University of Pennsylvania Museum through July 11th. Philadelphia has been a printmaking pioneer since its days as the workshop of the world. Now WRTI's Tom Keels takes us to Philadelphia on Stone, an exhibition at the Library Company of Philadelphia exploring the city's early lithography.
In the early 19th century, Philadelphia was both the creative and scientific capital of America, home to artists like Charles Wilson Peale and engineers like Benjamin Henry Latrobe. Art and science merged in 1819 when a local painter created the first lithographic print in the United States, says Erica Piola, assistant curator of prints and photographs at the Library Company of Philadelphia.
Lithography is a first associated with Philadelphia, with Bass Otis, who was a portrait artist in Philadelphia. He created the first American lithograph in 1819. The actual process was discovered circa 1798 in Bavaria, but Philadelphia was the first city where an actual lithograph was produced in America.
Initially, the appeal of the new printing process was limited to painters and scientists, who used it to reproduce artwork or technical illustrations. The first commercial lithographer did not open his doors in Philadelphia until 1828, but the new technique quickly revolutionized the city's printing industry. Lithography was faster and cheaper than engraving, a laborious process which involved carving images onto a metal or wooden surface.
It's a planographic printing process. You're writing with a special crayon or special ink on a stone. And because of that, it allowed for larger print runs than engraving. A copper plate or a wood block would start to wear down. So with lithographs, you'd get thousands of impressions from the same stone, which wasn't really possible with a copper plate or a wood block.
In an exhibition called Philadelphia on Stone, the first 50 years of commercial lithography in Philadelphia, 1828 to 1878, The Library Company of Philadelphia is exploring how local lithographers have depicted their city. Linda Wisniewski, print department assistant at the Library Company, believes that the prints on display document Philadelphia's evolution into a great industrial and mercantile metropolis during this time.
But it's also pride in the city, too, in these new buildings going up and the booming industry. It does say a lot about Philadelphia's pride, and I don't know that you hear that so much anymore. We were a city comparable to New York, and I think that kind of shows as well.
Lithography became the primary advertising medium of the age, especially after the introduction of chromolithography, or colored lithographs, in the 1850s. Erica Piola says these advertisements usually showed a business's physical location rather than what it produced or sold.
And at that time, you're not really showing any products so much. You showed the business where you could get the product.
For instance, the lithograph for the McCalla Hat and Cap Manufactory at 252 Market Street shows little headgear. The focus is on the workers and customers thronging the three-story brick building, its inventory-packed storeroom, and the boxes waiting to be loaded on the horse-drawn wagon parked out front. Jeffrey Ray, senior curator at the Atwater Kent Museum, sees these lithographs as going beyond promoting individual businesses to celebrate the dynamic new city.
Philadelphia was very much in the midst of the change of the American economy from agricultural to manufacturing and commercial. The images that you see of the city are of a vital city with the streets with people on them, with the sidewalks with people there, and of really active commercial interest going on.
And Philadelphia's artistic heritage gave its lithographs a unique aesthetic quality, despite their commercial nature.
There was a genuine effort to create these images that had clouds that looked like real clouds in them, that the streets looked like real streets. It has produced a visual record of the city that I don't think is equal to any other American city.
Commercial lithography reached its peak during the 1876 centennial, when thousands of prints celebrated Philadelphia's magnificent World's Fair. But by 1900, advertisers had turned to photographs and line drawings, relegating lithography to its original role as an artistic medium. Erica Piola included works by two contemporary printmakers, Kip Deeds and Roberta Delaney, in the exhibit to show the continuing influence of lithography on the graphic arts.
19th century lithography in Philadelphia still has an influence on 21st century. For instance, Kip Deeds, he uses historical themes in his lithographs. And Roberta Delaney, you can sort of see in the work that's going to be in the exhibit, the framing techniques that she used are similar to framing techniques that they used in 19th century lithography.
Philadelphia on Stone is the most visible element of a multi-stage enterprise spearheaded by the Library Company in partnership with other archival institutions. Plans are underway for an online catalog of more than 800 prints of the city, an illustrated biographical dictionary of early lithographers, and a collection of essays. Together, these projects will demonstrate how commercial lithography painted an indelible portrait of Philadelphia during its heyday as the workshop of the world.
WRTI's Tom Keels. Philadelphia on Stone, the first 50 years of commercial lithography in Philadelphia, 1828 to 1878, is at the Library Company of Philadelphia at 1314 Locust Street through October 15th. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester and performed by Symphony at Sea under its music director, Rossin Milanoff. The program's production associate is Eric Brannan. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter. Thanks for listening.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.